So we're continuing in our journey through the book of 1 Timothy. Last time we were in 1 Timothy, Paul dealt with the financial support of widows by the church. And Paul made a distinction between those widows who should receive such financial support and those who should not receive such financial support. Between true widows, to use Paul's language, and those who aren't true widows. Again, to use Paul's language. And Paul made clear that a true widow, in other words, one who should receive financial support from the church, is a widow who has true need and true spirituality. True need, she must actually need financial support. And true spirituality, her need can't arise from self-indulgence. Instead, she must be godly. Now, Paul is going to continue to talk about the care of widows in our verses for this evening. And he's going to make another essential distinction that must inform the church in terms of how they are to care for widows. And it's the distinction between young and old. The distinction between young and old. Paul in our verses distinguishes between older widows and younger widows, and he makes clear that the age of a widow needs to be factored in terms of how the church cares for those amongst it who are widows. Now again, like last time, it's very easy to fall into the trap of thinking that Paul is being harsh here by making distinctions. But when you look at what he actually says, it's pure and beautiful wisdom. And we're going to see that this evening. So let's begin. This is verse 9. Let a widow be enrolled if she is not less than 60 years of age, having been the wife of one husband, and having a reputation for good works, if she has brought up children, has shown hospitality, has washed the feet of the saints, has cared for the afflicted, and has devoted herself to every good work. So there's some debate over what the word enrolled here refers to. This could refer to a role of those widows who are eligible to serve in the church. So much like men have to meet certain qualifications before being formally recognized as being equipped to serve in the church as elders and deacons, at Ephesus there was a formal role of widows recognized as being equipped to serve in the church. So it's a role of service, in other words. Or, the other opinion, is that this is simply a role of support. So it's not a role formally recognized those widows who were equipped to serve the church. Rather, it's a role formally recognizing those widows who are eligible to receive support from the church. Now, I think it's both, if you want my opinion. I think it's both. I think it's both a role of support and a role of service. I think it's mainly a role of support, but obviously, if service is possible on the part of the widow, then service is expected. So I think what Paul is probably referring to here is a special role of true widows. So widows with a true need, widows with true spirituality, who have committed the rest of their lives to serving the church as they are able, and who serve the church as they are able with the support of the church. Now clearly, it's important to point this out, clearly, Paul isn't encouraging the church by talking about the special role of service and support. Paul isn't encouraging the church to ignore cases of true need, right? So when you read through this criteria, enroll a widow if she's less than 60 years of age, Paul isn't saying, if you have a widow who meets all of the criteria we saw last time, but is 59, then Paul is saying here, just got to wait for your birthday, and then you'll get on the roll and you'll be fine. Right, Paul's not saying that. Nor though, this is important, nor is Paul saying, and as soon as you hit your birthday, you can just kick back and relax and the church will foot the bill. You don't have to worry about any form of service whatsoever, even if you're able to serve. Paul's not doing that either. So this is a special role of widows, those who have committed the remainder of their lives to serving the church, and those to whom the church has committed to support financially. That's what I think is going on here. Now, I love how practical Paul is in having such a role. Right? You often hear people say things like, well, you know, when it comes to godliness and when it comes to service, helping people. It really just should be organic. You know, it really should just be organic. You shouldn't make it formal. You shouldn't make lists or anything like that. It just needs to be organic and kind of informal. You should need to tell that to Paul, because he didn't think that. There's a need. There's a need for the church to be served and a need for the church to support those serving it. And Paul says, do something formal. Make a list. Make a list. I love how practical Paul is here. Now let's look at the criteria that a person needs to meet to get on this list. Verse 9. Let a widow be enrolled if she is not less than 60 years of age, having been the wife of one husband. So firstly, age is a factor here. Age is a factor here. Before the church commits to supporting these widows in a formal sense, so putting them on this list of support and service, it has to be fairly certain that they won't be getting off this list until they die. It's a fairly final thing in that regard. And that's confirmed in verse 11. Paul says, don't enroll younger widows. And I think that's part of this age requirement here. It has to be fairly certain that once you get on this list, you're not going to be getting off this list until you die. Secondly, the wife of one husband. Now again, I don't think this should be interpreted woodenly. Right? If a woman was married at 20, widowed at 21, married again, widowed at 59, Paul isn't saying, well, tough luck. You know. What Paul's concerned with here is her godliness. She needs to have been a faithful wife to be enrolled formally to serve the church and be supported by the church. Just like elders need to be faithful husbands, she needs to have been a faithful wife. Now, just as somewhat of an aside here, the Bible places a huge premium on family life as it relates to one's eligibility to serve in the church. The Bible places a huge premium on family life as it relates to one's eligibility to serve in the church. Paul said earlier, right, chapter 3, if a man cannot manage his own household, how will he care for God's church? The answer is, he can't. He has no business caring for God's church if he cannot care for his own family. If a man cannot manage his own household, he has no business trying to lead in the church. If the influence that a man has on his own family, if that's negative, then he's the last guy that you want to have influencing the church. Now that's just common sense, but unfortunately, it's not that common. So many Christians allow themselves to be influenced by people without stopping and going, wait a second, what's this person's life like? What's this person's family life like? What's his influence been like on others? Paul says here, consider a widow's life before you enroll them to serve with the support of the church. Again, just like with elders. Now look with me at verse 10, because we see that theme continue. Verse 10. And having a reputation for good works, if she has brought up children, has shown hospitality, has washed the feet of the saints, has cared for the afflicted, and has devoted herself to every good work. In order to be enrolled for church-supported service, a widow needs to have already have a record of service. And again, that stands to reason. As with elders and deacons, service needs to be evident before the church comes in with support. She needs to have a reputation for good works. Now notice what Paul considers good works here. I love this. Notice what Paul considers good works. Bringing up children. That's a good work. Bringing up children is a good work. Raising children is a good work. What a wonderful reality that the Bible calls child rearing a good work. Often when we think of good works, we think of going to Africa, working as a missionary somewhere. We think of something extraordinary. We don't think of changing nappies, which I had to do today. Massive blowout. Unbelievable. But we don't think of that as a good work. Making meals, reading stories, doing time out, putting kids to bed. We don't think of those things as good works. Before I was a parent, I had no idea that the scariest part of my life would be the 10 feet from the bed to the door after Henry's fallen asleep. It's petrifying trying to get there without waking him up once he's finally fallen asleep. But again, that's all part of child-rearing, and the Bible calls that a good work. This week I was reading Martin Luther on the Beatitudes, and I came across this wonderful quote in this regard. Listen to this. "That must be called a pure work and heart, although a man or maidservant in the house performs a dirty, filthy task as hauling manure or washing and cleaning children. Therefore, it is a shameful perversion when one pays so little attention to the relations that are embraced in the Ten Commandments and gapes after other special, showy works, just as if God had not as pure a mouth or eyes as we, or as pure a heart and hand when he makes both man and woman. How should then such works or thoughts make an impure heart?" Raising children is a good work. As dirty as it is sometimes. As dirty as it was for me this afternoon. It's a good work. Secondly, showing hospitality. Again, the picture of good works here is so much more vibrant than the one we often carry around in our heads. Opening your home to others for meals and fellowship, being a hospitable person, opening your heart to others is a good work. Thirdly, wash the feet of the saints. This was the task of a slave. Yet a godly woman is a woman who volunteers to do that task. Humble, menial, lowest of the low service of other Christians is a good work. And finally, she has cared for the afflicted, caring for the afflicted person in front of you, seeking to bring comfort in the midst of affliction is a good work. And Paul says, those who are to be enrolled on this formal role of service to the church and support from the church must have a reputation for such good works, indeed devoted to such good works, not just those listed, as Paul closes verse 10, every good work. Now, before we move to looking at younger widows, the other side of the distinction that Paul makes here, I just want to make a couple of comments by way of application here. Firstly, in terms of applying what we've seen so far, we need to be aware of the various needs in our midst as a church. We need to be aware of the various needs in our midst as a church. Paul sets an example here of being aware of the various needs in the congregation and formally attending to them in a way that's appropriate, especially the needs among us of the most vulnerable portions of our population, of our demographic. That might be difficult, but it's important. Perhaps we can talk more about what that practically looks like at a membership meeting, but the principle is clear. We need to be aware of the needs in our midst and deal with them appropriately and with love and compassion. Secondly, though, even now, in terms of application, this text is a call to devote ourselves to good works. Right? What Paul lists here as good works are the works that should have characterized a woman even before she was a widow. Which means that even if you're not a widow, this is descriptive of the life that you were called to lead. Even if you're a man, this is a descriptive of the life that you were called to lead, a life devoted to good works. Raising children, showing hospitality, washing the feet of the saints, caring for the afflicted. That's what the Christian life should look like. And the reason that's what the Christian life should look like, the reason that that's the case, that that's what the Christian life should look like, is because that's what the life of Christ looked like. Although Christ didn't have children, he cared for the disciples like they were children, teaching them, bearing with them, being patient with them, bringing them into maturity. Christ showed hospitality, warmly bringing people in. He literally washed the disciples' feet. He took on the role of a slave to cleanse them, and he cared for the afflicted. He brought comfort and peace to those who needed it. And he does that for every believer, even you this evening. He cares for you like a child. He warmly embraces you. He took on the role of a slave, not to cleanse dirt from your feet, but even more to cleanse the sin from your soul. And he comforts you in all of your affliction. And the Christian life is a life of service, simply reflecting him who has already served you. Moving on to younger widows, this is verse 11. But refuse to enroll younger widows, for when their passions draw them away from Christ, they desire to marry, and so incur condemnation for having abandoned their former faith. Firstly, Paul's not saying anything against marriage here. He's not saying anything against marriage here. Remember earlier, Paul had actually called satanic any forbidding of marriage. So Paul can't be saying anything against marriage here. Rather, what he says confirms what we saw earlier in terms of age, right? So evidently, the women who got on this role weren't expected to get off it until death. They were basically committed to supporting, they were committing to supported service to the church until they died or could no longer serve. And when Paul says they incur condemnation for having abandoned their former faith, he means they've abandoned that commitment. Now, for obvious reasons, it's much more likely that a younger widow is going to be pulled in that direction of abandoning her commitment to full-time supported service of the church in favour of marriage, namely because marriage is much more likely in general for a younger person than it is for an older person. So Paul says, don't even enroll them. But it gets even worse. Not only are they more likely to be pulled in the direction of marriage and abandon their former commitment to supported service to the church, Paul says, verse 13, besides that, they learn to be idlers, going about from house to house, and not only idlers, but gossips and busybodies, saying what they should not. Now clearly this isn't a description of all young widows, but of those at the Ephesian church. So Paul says, don't enroll them. And you'll remember, if you think about this in light of the problem at Ephesus, men had risen up and were teaching different doctrine to that which Paul had taught. So right believing had gone out the window, and with it right living had gone out the window. And so Paul had said, charge men not to teach any different doctrine, so teach right believing. Why? So that right living can follow. The aim of our charge is love that issues forth from a pure conscience, from a pure heart and a good conscience and a sincere faith. And here we see Paul apply that concern practically, that concern about doctrine and right living practically. He says here, don't enroll younger widows, because by putting them on full-time support, you're supporting them in their idleness. It's easy to be idle when someone else is paying the bill. So Paul says, don't do it. And not just that. While the church is paying the bills, they're going around saying what they shouldn't. They're gossips and busybodies. They've got nothing better to do, so they're injecting themselves into other people's business and potentially even promoting the same kind of nonsense teaching that these Ephesian elders were promoting. Paul is practically, in other words, dealing with the main problem that was taking place at Ephesus. So Paul says, don't enroll them. Instead, verse 14. Look at verse 14. So I would have younger widows marry, bear children, manage their households, and give the adversary no occasion for slander. Verse 15, for some have already strayed after Satan. Instead of enrolling them, Paul says, encourage them instead to get married and fill their lives with godliness, bearing children, managing their households, giving the adversary no occasion for slander. And then Paul closes with the theme we've already seen, verse 16. If any believing woman has relatives who are widows, let her care for them. Let the church not be burdened, so that it may care for those who are truly widows. Again, first port of call for the care of widows is the family, not the church. We saw that last time, so I won't repeat what we've already seen there. Now, as we close, I just want to say a few things by way of application. Firstly, look at the nature of the bad works that we see here. We saw earlier, right? That good works were very ordinary, earthly things, raising children, so forth. We see that repeated here. Marry, bear children, manage their households. Now look with me at the nature of bad works, because it's really the inverse of that in many ways. It's being idle. It's gossiping. It's being a busybody. When we think of bad works, what do we often think of? We think of things that are in your face bad, right? Adultery, fornication, right? Theft, murder, things that are in your face obviously bad. We don't think of saying things you shouldn't say. We don't think of sharing tasty morsels of information behind other people's backs. We don't think of injecting ourselves into other people's business purely for the sake of indulging our curiosity, purely for the sake of serving ourselves. We don't think of simply being idle. But those are bad works. And works that Paul speaks about in the strongest language. He says some have already strayed after Satan. So in a manner of speaking, you could say that in the same way godliness is very ordinary, ungodliness is also very ordinary. In fact, it's so ordinary, it often slips under our radars. It's not gossip. I'm just sharing it so that you can pray for them. Right? It's not busybodying. I'm just concerned. It's not saying things that I shouldn't say. I'm just a talker. I'm like that. I'm not idle. I'm just kind of laid back. It's kind of my personality. We need to be so careful. Secondly, in terms of application, look at how practical Paul is. I love this. Look at how practical he is. Paul gives, this is wonderful, it's easy to miss, but I don't want you to miss it. Paul gives a practical solution to a spiritual problem. Paul gives a practical solution to a spiritual problem. Paul says, this is what's happening with these younger widows. They become idlers, gossips, and busybodies. They stray after Satan. So that's a spiritual problem, right? It's a moral problem. It's a spiritual problem. It's a sin problem. What's the solution? What does he say? I would have them marry. It's a very practical, very earthly, very ordinary solution. All too often, we think what? We think spiritual problem, spiritual solution. Right? Sin problem, spiritual solution. Moral problem, spiritual solution. Struggling with sin, that's a spiritual thing. You need to pray more. You need to read your Bible more. You need a spiritual solution. Maybe you do. Or maybe you need to get more sleep, as another example of a practical solution. Maybe you need to eat better. Maybe you need to exercise more. We see that principle here. You have a practical solution to a spiritual problem. As another example, think about having a short temper. Right? That's a sin problem. But it's a sin problem that what? That's often tied to lack of sleep. And so in order to solve that sin problem, sleep, very ordinary, very practical, is part of the solution. I love D.A. Carson on this point. I've quoted this before, but I want to quote it again. Listen to this. If you are among those who become nasty, cynical, or even full of doubt when you are missing your sleep, you are morally obligated, right? Listen to that. Morally obligated to try to get the sleep you need. We are whole, complicated beings. Our physical existence, this is the whole principle, our physical existence is tied to our spiritual well-being, to our mental outlook, to our relationships with others, including our relationship with God. Sometimes the godliest thing you can do in the universe is get a good night's sleep. Not pray all night, but sleep. So they're not denying that there may be a place for praying all night. I'm merely insisting that in the normal course of things, spiritual discipline obligates you to get the sleep that your body needs. And again, we see that same theme coming through here. Paul gives a natural, practical, ordinary solution, marriage, to a spiritual problem, the sin of idleness, of gossip, and being a busybody. So I say all of that to say this, don't fall into the trap of simplistic thinking. Right? Spiritual problems only ever have spiritual solutions. You do hear Christians who say that and who believe that. It's not true. It's actually profoundly unbiblical. Thirdly, and finally, this should all be brought back to Christ. As we saw last time, caring for widows is so close to the heart of Christ that even in his most agonizing moments, he was doing it. You remember that? On the cross, it says, John, behold your mother. To Mary, he says, behold your son. But even this evening, we should bring everything back to Christ. In terms of even what we've seen of young widows and the sins that they were prone to, we should think about those things in light of Christ and in light of the gospel. These sins that Paul is so eager for these young widows to avoid, what are they? They're an inversion of what we see in Christ, in the gospel. Right? So idleness, preferring comfort and ease to active service, that's a total inversion of what we see of Christ and what we see in Christ. Christ didn't choose the comfort and ease of heaven over service. Instead, he came down, and he came down to serve you if you believe in him. Gossip, spreading other people's dark secrets abroad, that's not what Jesus does with your dark secrets. It's not. What does Jesus do with your dark secrets? The things you've thought, the things you've done that you don't want anyone else to know about. What does he do with them? He doesn't spread them abroad. He takes them to the grave. He takes them to the grave. The worst things you've done, the worst things you've thought, Jesus says, these are dying with me. I'm not going to remember them anymore. Being a busybody, involving yourself in others' business purely for your own welfare and enjoyment. Again, we don't see Jesus doing that. He gets involved with us for our welfare, not because he is lacking, but because we are lacking and he wants to fill us. And that's what Paul wants for Christians, to reflect Christ. And that's really what the Christian life is all about at the end of the day. As we saw earlier, a life of busy, ordinary service, reflecting him who in love first served us. May it mark us as a church. Let's pray.